Questions?
It will be.
Our final speaker of the morning is Gwen Jones.
Thank you. Thank you and good morning. Today I'm going to talk with you about people with sensory disabilities. Yesterday it was people with mobility impairments. And this is a topic that I feel really passionate about, but I'll try to stay within the time limit. You know what? This doesn't work, the keyboard. Let's try this.
There you go.
We're going to skip the disclaimers. Y'all saw them yesterday. For our objectives, I wanted to, first of all, investigate comorbidities among people with sensory disabilities, and that included people who had vision problems, who had difficulty seeing even when they were wearing glasses, and people with hearing problems, and I'll give you a greater definition about that later. And then I wanted to look at some ways, consider some ways that public health interventions might help to improve the health of people with sensory impairments. Our data source is the National Health Interview Survey sample adult files from 2000 to 2007. And we looked at several factors, physical health status, depressive symptoms, and this is symptoms now, not DSM-IV diagnostic criteria. We looked at a number of chronic conditions and health behaviors. And then the procedures we used, of course, were crosstab and logistic regression in Sudan. And for the polychotomous outcome measures, we fit generalized logic models using the same predictors as the logistic regression. And we can control for several demographic factors, such as age, sex, health, marital status, education, and income. And our conceptual framework was the ICF, the International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health. I back-coded survey questions to the ICF framework, and I've included the codes in the slides, but I didn't memorize them all, so those of you who can see the slides, you can read them yourselves. Okay, the ICF is a WHO classification, and it allows us to look at body function and structure and activities and participation and environmental factors for people with and without disabilities. Now, the types of sensory loss, in the NHIS ask questions about vision loss, and that is, do you have trouble seeing even when wearing glasses or contact lenses? And there's a subset of blind people who are totally blind. I didn't look at them. They are included in the visual impairment variable, but you can separate them out if you want to. And then for hearing, the question for part of the years was, do you have a little trouble hearing, a lot of trouble hearing, or are you deaf? And then for the last few years it's been, do you have a mild, moderate, or severe hearing loss, or are you deaf? And anybody who said yes to any of those particular items was included in the hearing loss category. And then there are some people who had both sensory impairments. And here's the breakdown of sensory impairments, vision and hearing, for minorities and for non-Hispanic whites. And the non-Hispanic whites have slightly higher vision in terms of percentage of people with vision loss and a much higher percentage of people with hearing loss. And physical health status, we looked at fair, poor, good, and excellent, very good health. This is fair, poor. And it's a stair step, a staircase, you might say, going up. And the cream-colored people are the whites with no sensory loss. The purple ones are minorities, the whole group of minorities. Green is the sensory impaired people, all of them. And then yellow is the minorities with sensory impairments. And those included everybody but non-Hispanic whites. And then we looked at depressive symptoms, which included feelings of sadness or hopelessness or worthlessness that substantially interfered with a person's daily activities in the 30 days prior to being surveyed. And we computed the K6 scale of psychological distress for these folks, which allows you to look at the levels of psychological distress. And it's been shown to be sensitive to separating out cases and non-cases of mood disorders. It just doesn't tell you which one they have. And these are the variables that we use, like feelings of sadness, hopelessness, worthlessness, or that everything is an effort. And they have to be pretty pervasive before you can be included in that group. And here's this is depressive symptoms. And the people with sensory impairments, that group had the highest. And then minorities with sensory impairments came in second for that. We looked at mobility limitations because some people had all three impairments. And in the ICF, changing and maintaining body position, and the two variables that were associated with that, or two of the variables that I looked at, were bending and stooping. If you had difficulty with it, or if you had difficulty sitting or standing over a sustained period of time without support. And then walking and moving around. Did you have difficulty walking three blocks? Did you have difficulty climbing 10 steps without resting? And here are the folks with mobility limitations. And the whites are more likely to have them than minorities, but the sensory impaired people are the most likely to report mobility impairments. And if you think about it, for those with dual, they have all three. And that really presents some challenges, I know, because I have all three. And you have to really think outside the box to get things done. And of course, people with minorities with sensory impairments came in. They were the second highest group. And then we looked at physician-diagnosed chronic conditions. Did the doctor tell you that you had hypertension, diabetes, heart problems, and breathing problems? And the heart problems included things like myocardial infarction, angina, coronary heart disease, and other types of heart disease. The breathing problems included emphysema, chronic bronchitis, and asthma. Here are the folks with hypertension, and again, we have a little bit of a staircase. Whites and minorities are pretty close, but then it jumps way up for sensory impaired people, and the minorities with sensory impairments had the most difficulty with this condition. And the same here for diabetes. The stair steps are more pronounced, and the people with minorities who have sensory impairments have the highest rate of hypertension. And then here's heart problems. And the pattern is one similar that you've seen for like mobility limitations. The people with sensory impairments had the highest, and then minorities with sensory impairments were the next highest group here. And then the same for breathing problems, it was a similar pattern, though sensory impaired people and minorities with sensory impairments were really close in terms of the people who had breathing problems percentages. We looked at two self-reported health conditions that people said that they had, like pain and swelling in their joints and low back pain. And this is for joint symptoms. And here, again, the sensory impaired people were the most likely to report it, with minorities with sensory impairments were second. And then low back pain, a similar pattern here. But those with sensory impairments, whether they were the whole category or minorities, had, again, the highest percentages of low back pain. Health behaviors, we looked at smoking, that is, if a person smoked several days a week or every day. We looked at current drinking. They had one or more alcoholic beverages a week. And then weight problems, BMI, greater than or equal to 25, and a subset of that obesity, BMI greater than or equal to 30, physical inactivity, a person exercised less regularly, less than once a week, or not at all. And here's smoking. Now, minorities, as a group, were the least likely people to smoke. Whites were much more likely to smoke. And then minorities with sensory impairments had the highest percentage, I think 23%. But they smoke less than people with mobility limitations. And then here's current drinking. The whites and then sensory impaired people were the most likely to report current drinking. Weight problems, we've got a stair step again. It goes up for each category with minorities with sensory impairments were the most likely to report having a weight problem. And the same for obesity. Though the distinctions among the groups isn't as great as it is for weight problems. About 2/3 of minorities with sensory impairments had weight problems, and about 1/3 of that group within the weight problems had obesity. Then we have physical inactivity. The minorities and minorities with sensory impairments were the most likely people to report that they were very physically inactive. Thank you. Okay, for the results, for health, fare poor health, the odds were 6 times those of whites with no impairment. Depressive symptoms, more than twice. The odds are more than twice that they would have depressive symptoms, minorities with sensory impairments. Minorities with sensory impairment people, all of them had all the chronic conditions to a much greater extent than those without any sensory impairments who were white. And the frequent flyers there were diabetes and mobility limitations. For health behaviors, the biggest problems for minorities with sensory impairments were weight problems, obesity, and physical inactivity. And the conclusions, people with minorities with sensory impairments face a number of really severe health risks, threats to their health and well-being, and having minority status and sensory impairment presents really substantial barriers to receiving health care information, health promotion information, and health promotion interventions as they are currently being presented. And part of this is because of the communication difficulty. In terms of reaching out for communication, health messages and interventions need to be tailored to the lived experience of people with sensory impairments, especially if they have both. And it has to be also culturally appropriate for minorities. And it has to be age appropriate and disability appropriate. And what I mean by that is people with sensory impairments, depending on when they get them during the life course, whether they're younger or older, it depends, that kind of colors what kind of adaptive technology or strategies they're going to use. Younger people who grow up with Braille and the technology that you use with that are going to be much more proficient in it. You can't just throw a Braille document at a person with a vision impairment and think that they read Braille, because they don't. Most of them don't. And young people are going to be more savvy on the web, too, than, say, those who have acquired their impairments during old age, like because they have AMD or glaucoma, or they're experiencing age-related hearing loss versus hearing loss at an earlier age. So you really have to look at the person's age, where they're coming from culturally, and where they are on the scale of disability impairment in terms of figuring out how to communicate best with that person for health messages. And one way to do that is to collaborate with minority organizations, disability organizations, community-based organizations that work with people with disabilities, neighborhood coalitions and churches and houses of worship, because sometimes there are whole congregations of deaf individuals, and there are a lot of minorities, especially African Americans, are frequent churchgoers, and that's a way to reach them. And also, a lot of times, people with disabilities, that's where they find a lot of social contact, so that's where you can reach them the best. This is very important, nothing about us without us. Interventions can really fail if you don't understand the interface of minority status and sensory impairment and how minority groups look at sensory impairment and the ways that they cope with it. Best way to do that is to include them as planners in intervention, as advisors, and as participants. A lot of times we have the advisors and participants, but very seldom planners, and things would be more successful if they were. That was a text slide of that, and then this is my contact information. Do I have any time left?
Sure.
At all?
Yes.
How much? A minute? Okay. I just want to say this to you, that public health has pretty much ignored this group. And I feel really passionate about this, and as long as I have breath in my body, I'm going to talk about it. And so far, some of the folks at CDC haven't listened to me in terms of putting people with multiple disabilities as a priority for surveillance. And if they don't, I'm going to do it anyway, because we, as people age, as things happen to them, they need interventions that are going to be suitable in the interface of especially three disabilities at one time. You have to really do some thinking and understand the individual and how they function and what life experiences are like for them if you're going to be successful. So whenever you come across this situation, I'm asking you to really think carefully and invite the person to plan with you about different interventions. And in that way, we can start addressing some of these health problems that really shouldn't exist. And I thank you very kindly for your attention.
Before we open questions to the panel, are there specific questions for Gwen?
Yes. Hi. My name is Adama, and I'm here from the Braille Institute in Los Angeles. And I just wanted to add to something that you had said in your information. Most people who are currently visually impaired or legally blind were sighted. It's something like close to 90%. And baby boomers, which will be the silver tsunami in about 5 years or so, all experiencing visual impairment, all have different kinds of chronic diseases that you're trying to manage, no matter how young they may appear. And so they will have sensory limitations. And the important thing to remember is they have been sighted, so they have used print, and they will not be using Braille, especially if they have chronic diseases such as diabetes, and that leads to neuropathy. So they wouldn't be reading Braille anyway for any purpose. They might be using large print, which would be like 18-point font. They might have macular degeneration, like among white people, which, especially older white women, which would mean that they would need high contrast, maybe yellow against black versus white against black,
right,
for color. They might be using different forms of magnification, powers of magnifiers that are higher than you would get at CVS or Thrifty or any of those kind of locations. So it's not just to be sensitive that this is a special group. This is thousands upon thousands of people that will be coming through that are, you know, just newly emerging seniors, if you will, that will be having visual impairment.
That's right.
Not legally blind, but at least severely visually impaired.
And they're going to have different reactions.
So that one part where you said to work together with disability organizations, we all, in the blindness field anyway, we do blindness rehabilitation, which is the same thing. You know, I have an MPH. So skills building, behavior change, it's the same thing. It's just not prevention. It's all in the rehab area. So if you work with the organizations, they can give you the tools that you need to work more effectively with people who have vision or hearing loss, and then you can provide a better service. These are not necessarily special people. It's everyone coming through the door will be experiencing something like this in the next few years. So just be ready.
Thank you. And that's true. And I think also that we need to consider training people while they're in college. about these multiple disabilities issues. I used to teach physiatry residents, and I've also taught social work students. And we had guest speakers on Friday. We'd combine the two sections. And so when they'd ask who'd be speaking on the disability topic, I just told them I was bringing someone in who had experience in it and also was in the professional field. And I didn't tell them until we got the classes together. I gave them my condolences and told them they'd have to listen to me for the fifth day. But then I talked about the lived experience and what it was like. And I saw some differences in my students across the semester. And I really think that bringing in people with multiple disabilities, it makes them think about things that they've never thought of before, that they're going to need to know, especially working with people who are aging and may have two disabilities or triple disabilities.
Question for Gwen from Steve K. What happens if you divide the minorities into the different groups? I'm wondering whether it's the same thing that you see in general prevalence where, you know, the Native Americans are really high, Americans somewhat high, Asians low, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. In dividing them into groups, some of the groups that are in the NHIS data, you would have such small cell sizes that you're going to get some really strange-looking confidence intervals. But I've looked at people with mobility limitations along this line, and of course African Americans are the most likely group to have those.
Right.
And but I haven't split up the vision people because I don't have as many in the sample as I did for mobility limitations. I'd like to do that, and as I add some more data to the database, I think that that would be something that would be good to do.
Well, you're, of course, the master of combining years of the HIS. So.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah. It's fun, but it's tedious, but it's fun because then you get a lot of people in there and can come up. I mean, you get to see what the picture looks like. You know?
What I was going to suggest is if you're willing to analyze a different survey, you could, with limited information, use the American Community Survey. You'd have plenty of sample, and there is the question about sensory and the question about mobility, so you could do that with
every matter. And what's their sample size, though? About 5,000?
The American Community Survey is 3 million a year.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would probably work. That would probably work.
Uh-huh. So,
it depends on how frequently they sample people with disabilities, though, because some people, and also how they define it.
I'll talk to you offline about that.
Okay.
I mean, there's not a lot of depth, so you don't have a lot of health measures, but mm-hmm. you do have several disability.
What I want is a disability Framingham, but I can't find anybody with the money who would do it.
Hi, Gwen. This is Arun Karpur from Columbia
Hi.
University. I had a question. While you were examining the combined effect of being a minority status and sensory disabilities, have you examined that as an interaction effect as opposed to just being that as a main effect?
I looked at main and interactive effects, both.
Mm-hmm.
The people with the minorities with sensory impairments are the interaction between the two, and then had the main effects of just sensory impairment alone and minority alone. So, yes, I did. I looked at both of them.
When this is Gloria Crines, you know I'm new to the CDC, but it's going to, you've just thrown down the gauntlet, and it's going to be my job either
yes.
or to broaden the scope. So my question, in the spirit of the latter, is how do we start to develop statistical modeling, not unlike what Arun, I think, is trying to raise, is where we're really starting to look at these things together and looking to see how do we start to understand mobility, sensory, or mobility, vision, hearing. So that would be one part of the question. And the other would be, how do we start to deal with the data in that press the data a little bit further from straight report out on single behaviors, knowing that we're still stuck with cross-sectional data?
Yeah, we are. And that's unfortunate. There's not really any longitudinal data. And it would be good to have. But even... even with the cross-sectional, we're so far behind in that that it's going to take a while to catch up with some of the other areas. I think the first thing to understand is the effects of all three separately, like Arun was talking about, that you would look at the main effects, and then you would begin to look at the interactive effects of two of them together, and then all three, to see where they are in terms of their health status, health behaviors, and the kinds of chronic conditions that they get. And also, we need to deal with depressive symptoms, because it's not a given that people with disabilities should be depressed, but yet they're not getting the treatment that they need. And I think with that, because a lot of people just don't, health providers think that, oh, it's normal, you're depressed, you know. And if you're not depressed, they ask you why you're not. They do. I've had doctors say, are you depressed? And I said, no, should I be? And they said, yeah, with all your limitations, I'd be depressed. Well, I said, well, I'm not, okay. So that's an education right there. Some of them were significant above the interactive effects, and some were for the main. Main was more significant, and others were sometimes the interactive effect with minorities. Now, I have not looked at straight the whole group of vision, hearing, mobility. That's one of my next projects. And I will definitely look at each one of them and then how they all interact with each other. But this was just with the interaction between minorities and sensory impairments and then the main effects for those.
Hi, Glenn. Good morning. This is Lisa. I'm glad you made it here safely. I was previewing the schedule for today. There was another session called Evidence-Based Policy, Racial Disparity in Practice in Eye Care and Aging and the Impact on Vision, and that's in it's actually at the Marriott Marina, so that's a whole other location. But for those who are really interested in Gwen's topic, there's another session coming up next. The other thing I wanted to suggest, Gwen mentioned something about being culturally sensitive in the practice of this scenario, and the only thing I could suggest from the research that I've done, at least some of the literature reviews that I've done, is that minorities tend to get their health care later than sooner, and mm-hmm. diagnosis comes later than sooner. And that is a cultural practice, mm-hmm. Which has its basis in economics and trust. And sometimes there's a conflict in time also. If you're dealing with minority communities, they're really taxed just to survive from day to day. Get through the day. And so getting health care for the person, for the primary provider in the home, is difficult. They're busy caring for children, and culturally there tends to be some intergenerational care that takes place with grandmothers, and you know, so you get sandwiched caring for your kids and your parents, you know, often throughout the lifespan. And so it's not a bad cultural practice. It just is. Right. It's just what happens. So when you take care of minorities, you gotta think about their vision and hearing early. So if you're a practitioner, you ask about those questions rather earlier. The young, the woman said that even though the person looks fairly young, that they often have vision, that they will still have some vision problem or chronic condition that just isn't being spoken to.
Right. Also, minorities, different groups, may feel differently about disability than, say, some of the service providers that they go to. Some groups in some nations don't even have a word for disabled because they think of the person just as a person, and they may call them somebody, say, call them by their name, with a vision problem, or I'm not exactly how the phrase would be, but they really don't have a separate category for people with disabilities like we do. We separate people. And in some ways that's good in terms of intervention, but in other ways it's isolating. I think we definitely, that would be good. We need longitudinal data too in the worst way. I would even like to see, and I've talked to some people at NCHS about it, another disability survey with follow back. And because the data that we have now are like really old and people are using those still. And they're like 14 years old. And I've talked, and NCHS said, yeah, we'll field it and everything, you know. We just need the money. And when I mentioned to, like, where are we going to get the money, everybody has other priorities, you know. So if y'all happen to know somebody with, like, really deep pockets who's interested in this sort of thing, try to get them together with NCHS and some other disability groups so we can get those questions written and get them fielded and get some much more recent information, because I think that it's going to change. We'll see some changes from the data that we now have on the NCHS disability supplement. It all comes down to money, doesn't it? You know, a lot of times.
Are there any questions for the general panel?
This is a question for Catherine Graham, but Suzanne McDonald, I really just want to help her. You know, I just started to work. You know, I decided in health project, just started to work with the couple of local medical schools to include people with disability as a standardized patient program for the field for this year, M1 and M2. In your presentation for the work with M2 and M3, do you have kind of